The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
My name again is Darla McDonald, and I teach at Cary Christian School in Cary, North Carolina. I teach 9th grade human physiology, 12th grade physics, and also AP Physics 1 to some of our 12th graders. I'll also introduce my family to you. Here's a recent picture of myself and my four children. We were in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and obviously my husband's taking the picture, otherwise he'd be in it. But those are my four kids, Luke, Eva, Jonah, and Isaac. And we're doing something bad. Anybody know what we're doing bad? We're on the cannon. It's a no-no. Pretty soon after this, it's just such a cool picture, so I said yes to my children. But pretty soon the park ranger came along and said, ma'am, we're not supposed to be on the cannon. Yes, I know. I'm sorry, sir. But it was just such a great picture to have my kids up there. So anyway, these are my children, and we love history in addition to loving science. Again, a little bit about my educational background. I actually hold a degree in biology from the University of Maryland, College Park, and I'm just about finished with my master's in science education from North Carolina State University. And I'll be very excited when that is finished, so it's been a wonderful opportunity. I've also been a part of classical Christian education for 11 years. I've been in the classroom for over 11 years, and it's really an honor and a privilege to stand before you this afternoon, and be able to share a little bit about what I've learned over that time. Now, I've already mentioned this, but like many of you, I've attended numerous ACCS conferences, and I love attending the conferences because I leave inspired, rejuvenated to tackle the next school year. But I love it even more when I leave with practical, tangible ideas, resources, things that I can go home and sink my teeth into that are going to go along with all the theoretical, philosophical ideas that we have discussed as well. So my goal for you today is to leave this workshop filled with lists and ideas, tangible resources, practical ways that you can yourself and at your school develop that next generation of scientific thinkers. So we're going to get started by doing an activity. This is what we're going to be doing, and then we'll do it. You are going to be looking at two different science classrooms, and these, in essence, are prototypes of science classrooms, and you're going to answer the following questions, first in your brain, second with a partner, and then you are going to have to report out to the class. So here are the questions. First, did students in Classroom 1 or Classroom 2, and you'll figure out what that means in a moment, learn more? Why? So who learned more and why? And what end goal did each teacher have in that classroom? So these are your two questions that you're going to have to answer. So on to the classrooms. Now you'll notice in classroom number one, you're probably like, Darla, you have two links. Yes, I do, because in essence, it's a prototype. So I want to show you two examples of classroom one prototype, and then I'll show you a classroom two prototype. And I do have audio, but we might have to adjust it. Classroom 1 are actually videos from our classrooms at Cary Christian, and so if the audio and the video are not awesome, I'm going to apologize ahead of time, but here we go. This is a chemistry class. This chemistry class is studying pH. And then I'm going to show you also from this classroom prototype number one, one of my biology classes.
I think the blues are in here. Yeah, they weren't
flexible
enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Unspecific.
So I just feel like they're supposed to go in there for someone that
All right, so that was prototype number one. And yes, you're probably like, I have no idea what they were saying, and it was garbled. That's okay. You could see quite a bit and hear quite a bit of what that classroom was like. Now, classroom number two is also a biology class. And in this biology class, unfortunately, the only video is actually going to be the teacher's whiteboard, but you're going to be able to hear the audio from the classroom. And let me pull this one up. And this is one that's posted online.
Today, we're going to talk about section 7.2. Section 7.2 deals with the plasma membrane. All right, we looked at this cell over here. And we said the plasma membrane was what surrounds the cell. And we're going to look at it in some more detail than we've looked at it before. Are you guys ready? Yes. All right, let's go. Inside this section, first we're going to talk about maintaining a balance. Okay, that's very important when we're talking about the plasma membrane. Then we're going to talk about what the plasma membrane is. We're going to talk about the structure of the plasma membrane. And that is the content that we're going to deal with today. We're going to talk about maintaining a balance first. Plasma membrane is a boundary between the cell and its environment. If we didn't have a plasma membrane, there would be no overall structure, and the stuff that's inside would not be separated from the stuff that's outside. And we don't like that.
He's a funny guy. Alright, I'm going to pull this down, and I want you to take a moment and answer those questions. I'll go back to that slide. Did students in classroom number one and classroom number two learn more? I know it was a 20-second snippet. I know you couldn't necessarily hear everything going on, but you still should be able to see quite a bit and know quite a bit what was happening. And then what end goal did each teacher have in mind? I'll give you probably about a minute or two to think about it. Then I'll have you pair up. Actually, if you want to pair up, let's go ahead and just pair up because some of you guys are ready to talk. I can tell. I'm going to give you about 3 minutes with a neighbor. I want you to talk about the answers to these questions, and then we're going to report out and share. You may go. 3 minutes.
Thank you.
All right, it's already been 3 minutes, so let's come back together, and I want to hear out. I want to hear from at least three groups of people, and I want to know your answers to these questions. Now, in my own classroom, I just call on people, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, so you can raise your hand if you'd like to share what you thought these answers were. Yes, ma'am. Come back. All right, somebody else? Yes, ma'am. First of the gentleman up here did. I said, ooh, be careful. I might have something up my sleeve. Interesting. Somebody else. Oh, don't be shy. Somebody else wants to talk. All right, we'll go to the right hand side, yes, ma'am. Or this one. I'm actually going to go back to those three groups because not everyone answered the second question, which is fine. I didn't prompt as we went. So you said it depended upon the end goal. So what was the end goal of both classrooms? Other groups, I apologize, I don't remember where you guys were. I remember you guys in the back. What end goal did you feel like both classrooms had? Either one, because I know there's the lady behind you as well. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very good. We're going to move on for a second. So what is the end goal of our teaching? And a lot of you guys just referred to this. Is it to disseminate information, just tell the students what they need to know, or is it to teach them how to be lifelong learners? You're going to look at me and be like, well, duh, she just told us, right? It's to be lifelong learners. I mean, that's the goal of classical education. The problem, and I don't even think it's a problem, I guess the question is, aren't you supposed to do both? Because aren't we supposed to be teaching them to be lifelong learners, but at the same time, isn't there information to disseminate and to discover and to have them learn? Absolutely. So really, I feel like the question, I was having this discussion with these people here in the front, is how do we do both? What does that look like in the classroom to do both of those? So this is where we're headed today. Talking about science versus doing science. And before we go here, I need to tell you a story to give you a framework from which we're going to start. My daughter, as you saw in the picture earlier from Gettysburg, she was at the time of this story in the fourth grade. She's now entering eighth grade, about 4 years ago. She was in the fourth grade. They had just completed a unit on electricity. Now, she is an A student, got an A on the test. She memorized her sound off. She brought home her study guide. We memorized the study guide. She got an A on the test, the whole deal. We're sitting at the dinner, you know, the dining room table, eating dinner one night, talking about school, and she looks at me and goes, Mom, what's electricity? I looked at her like, didn't you just study that? Well, yeah, but well, what did your sound off say? I don't know. Okay. Well, didn't it say something about, and so I prompted her with electricity, the movement of electrons. Oh, yeah, movement of electrons. What does that mean? Okay. So I was like, well, let's play a little bit with electricity. So I told her, all right, let's put our socks on. And people who know me in this room know I'm crazy like this. We put our socks on, and we kind of scuffed along the carpet, and then I shocked her, right? And she was like, that's electricity. Remember, the electrons went from me to you. Remember, I picked them up from the carpet. We looked at batteries. We had just a really fun, geeky time at home, which we do a lot. And she was like, oh, this is exciting. I think I get it. What happened? She got the A. The teacher disseminated information very well. What happened? You guys get to answer. She didn't discover it herself? What else? No application. What else? Yes, ma'am. Right. I gave her context. I gave her understanding. And all we did was play. Really. That's all we did. And she was like, oh, I get it. This is cool. Let's talk for just a minute about what your science classrooms might look like at a classical Christian school. And don't get me wrong, a lot of things we're going to talk about today are not just true at classical Christian schools, but just schooling in general. But of course, we're going to focus there. Let's say you're an elementary school science teacher. How many of y'all are those? I was hoping we'd have a couple here. Yay, awesome. How many of y'all are middle school, high school? I would assume lots of the rest. Awesome. All right, so let's say you're an elementary school science teacher, or you teach science in your classroom, and let's say if this sounds familiar. Perhaps you might teach them a sound off. Maybe they'll have like a little test on that on their part. Maybe they'll do some worksheets. Maybe they'll review the worksheets, and you'll have a test. Sound a little bit familiar? If middle school or high school, maybe you lecture for a few days and they're taking their notes. Maybe you do an experiment. Then you do like a review game or review day, and then you take a test. Sound familiar? Yeah, like this is where a lot of us are living because it's how we were taught as well. What I would make again as my thesis point to you is that is just talking about science. That's not doing science. And so if we continue just to talk about science instead of doing it, we're going to continue to produce a lot of my daughters in the fourth grade, where she just was going through like, yeah, I know what electricity is. Yeah, this is great. What about we look at this right here? So, for instance, if you were teaching about simple machines, here's a whole list of all the different types of simple machines you might look at. An easy way to disseminate this information is this is an inclined plane, this is a wedge, this is a screw. How much different is it, though, if you get them outside saying, hey, let's see if we can lift up this jug of milk. Where do we put the bowling ball to make it easier? And then you get to talk about levers. Hey, I need to lift this load of bricks up high. How are we going to do that? Asking your students to problem solve. That seems like a very small difference, but it's huge. It's huge to go from talking about science to actually doing science. And ladies and gentlemen, if we want to develop the next generation of scientific thinkers, we have to stop telling them about science and actually have them do science. And the best way to do this is actually to teach students using a methodology called inquiry, or inquiry, however you want to say it. And I know for some of us in the high school or middle school, you might have heard of this before, but it really needs to be all the way down to kindergarten. I mean, this is how you teach science. Science is a subject of discovery and inquiry, and that's how you have to teach it. So what do we mean by this? Actually, I would love to pose it to the crowd. What do you think it means to teach science as inquiry? Or what does it mean to teach an inquiry-based class? Yes, ma'am. Right. Do you tell them the answer? That's exactly right. This is another way that I like to describe it to people. It's a methodology where teachers pose questions. And I want you to listen to the nouns that I use. Teachers pose questions. Students make observations. Students make predictions. Students use tools to analyze and interpret data. Teachers present case studies, particularly from history, to provide insight into the scientific inquiry process. Students design and conduct investigations. Students use argumentation to defend positions, use diagrams, figures, visualizations to convey complex scientific phenomena and information. What nouns was I using? Students. It's students. So in essence, what we need to be doing is we need to be teaching scientific content within the context of scientific practices. And what we're going to do for the rest of our time together is actually look at 8 scientific practices that you should be teaching your students. Because if you're teaching your students using inquiry, teaching them these practices, then you will develop the next generation of great scientific thinkers, because this is what they need to be doing. Now, I will tell you right now, I have borrowed these. These are not my ideas. I have borrowed these from the Next Generation Science Standards, the NGSS. I don't necessarily agree with everything that's in there, but I think these are great scientific practices that we can use as a reference tool when trying to figure out what do we want to be teaching our students as well. So let's go through these very briefly. Asking questions and defining problems. Students should be developing and using models. Students should be planning and carrying out investigations. They should be investigating and interpreting data. They should be using mathematical and computational thinking, constructing explanations and designing solutions. They should also be engaging in argumentation, obtaining, evaluating, and communicating information. So if we teach our students these practices, with the scientific content as we're teaching these practices, then we will be developing this next generation of scientific thinkers. So how do you teach these practices? And this, I think, is hard, because how many of you guys were actually taught those practices? That's awesome if you were. I wasn't. It was overhead projectors and notebooks. Here we go. Right? Taking notes. I can envision my teacher sitting on their chair with their overhead projector writing away. All right, so here we go. So let's say that you want to teach these scientific practices. One of the ways you should do this is always generate in your students a need to know. They need to know the answer, and they need to know it now. I want my students to be in my classroom. Ms. McDonald, how does that work? What happened? I want to know. I want them so excited that my classroom is electric. Man, that's kind of cool. But I actually want them to be electric and be, oh, I just want to know the information. I want to know the answer. The way to do that is to problematize your lesson. So any lesson that you're teaching, any content that you want to teach, make it a problem. Let's practice. I'm going to give you one. You make it a problem. Kidneys. You got to teach about kidneys. Come on, what's the problem? What happens when kidneys fail? What else? Say it again. How do they filter? You guys are being way too specific. Come on, what's the question? Why do I pee? That's the question. You guys are all like, what? Yeah, that's what a kid wants to know. Why do I pee? They think they pee, by the way, because they drink water. I guarantee if you were to ask most of your middle school or high schoolers, they'll be like, yeah, you pee out the water. No, you don't. You're clean in your blood. Let's talk about it, right? But that's what you do. You take everything that you want to teach and you make it a problem to solve. And I'll tell you what, my ninth grade boys, when I say, why do you pee? They have all kinds of crazy answers, and they're like, well, why do you pee, Miss McDonald? Oh, we're going to find out. Let's start working. Let's go. And they get excited about it. Ask thought-provoking questions to stir their curiosity. Let me give you an example here. Anybody know what this thing is on the left? Oh, really? Oh, I'm so sad. Nobody knows what this thing is on the left. Oh. It's a generator. It uses electromagnetic induction, if you know what that means, if you don't, who cares. So anyway, it's got a, it's actually how we're getting all this electricity right now, but anyway, it's another story. All it is a little light bulb. I don't teach with a podium. This is driving me nuts. Like, I need to move. Then you can't hear me. Okay, I'll try my best. All right, so there's a little light bulb in the front. That's what that is. It's like a little LED light bulb. All that is a coil of electrical copper wire. There's a magnet on top, and then a little wheel. No battery, no plugs, nothing. If you turn the wheel, the light bulb comes on. I can't tell you how many of my seniors, oh my God, guys, hey, hope you're having a great day. Sit down, we're going to get started. Today we're going to talk about electromagnetic induction. Anybody know what it is? No. Okay, cool. And then I get out my generator, and all I do is I start cranking the wheel, and the little light bulb comes on, and now how are you doing that? There's a battery. Nope, no battery. It's a magnet. Piece of copper wire, light bulb. How does that work? That's what we're going to figure out. I mean, that's what you want to do. They'll work for you when you get them that curious about it, when you pique their interest like that. Another way to generate this need to know is to use case studies, from history. And I'm actually going to pass out some information. Actually, you're going to do the passing, but here's some. I apologize if I was to actually copy every single piece of paper that I wanted to give you. They would probably get mad at me. So I only gave you a couple pages of each of these things that I'm going to go over. One of these is a case study about Jon Snow. And so, for instance, if you're going to teach a lesson on pathogens, immune systems, disease transmission, anything like that, use a case study. The kids love historical case studies. And this just gives you an example of something I've gotten online. Again, I don't come up with a lot of these ideas. I just keep passing them along. But when you incorporate the historical aspect of our understanding, our scientific understanding, the students love it. And, of course, this is about Jon Snow and how he figured out what was actually causing cholera. And it's actually, anybody read the book, The Ghost Map, by Stephen Johnson? Oh, no. You need to go home and read that. Okay, so it's called The Ghost Map by Stephen Johnson, and it's actually the whole story about how we figured out what cholera was and why it was killing so many different people based, again, upon this guy's work. But anyway, you should be using these case studies to really pique the interest of your students, and what a great integration of history and science as well, which I love to do all the time. So let's review for just a second. By generating in our students a need to know, I want you to go back to your list of scientific practices. What have we already taught them? So by generating in our students a need to know an answer, what scientific practices have we already taught them? Asking questions. What else? Anything? Observations. What else? Investigation, sure. Yeah. You can keep going. You guys are doing great. All right. Another way that we are going to teach scientific practices, something I already mentioned, is through the use of guided inquiry or scientific inquiry. Now, I have talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. It was in my talk last year. But another page in there, again, you're not seeing all the pages from these activities. I could only copy a couple of them. So please go home and Google them, that type of thing, and you can find the rest of it. But anyway, this is an example of what's called a process-oriented guided inquiry learning, POGL, and this is one on human blood cell typing. Has anyone ever used these POGL lessons before? I hope you like them. I love them. Okay, good. You're all like, yes, I love them. Okay, because I love them with a capital L-O-V-E. They are fabulous for guiding students through these learning processes. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so everything I'm talking about is also on the resource list, so if you look at your outline, but it says, oh yeah, I wrote everything for you, because I know how that is. So POGL, P-O-G-I-L, it's Process-Oriented Guided Inquiry Learning. Mm-hmm. It's a whole initiative that was not started by classical people, but it's so classical, so I love it. Yeah, so anyway, human blood cell typing, I don't know about you guys, but it's something that always trips up my students. What's antigen, antibody, who has what? Oh, I mean, it can be really crazy. So if you're just teaching them from the aspect of disseminating information, they're just going to go home and memorize the little chart, right? Blood type A has A, antigen B, antibodies. I mean, they're just going to memorize that chart, but they really don't get it. If you teach them using this guided inquiry process, they're going to get it. And I love the deep application questions that you'll see in these activities so that they have to understand what's going on with the antigen-antibody complex. Again, if you understand it, fine, if you don't, with these as well. So please, yeah, look at that, and I encourage you to use that guided inquiry learning because it's going to help you guide your students along. It also requires your students to be active in class. This is the most talking I ever do in a class. Most of the time, I want my students talking more than I am or equal to what I'm talking. And what I mean by that is obviously not being disrespectful talking, but talking to each other, actually learning and practicing those scientific practices that we've been looking at. All right, so in addition to generating in my students a need to know and with teaching with the use of guided inquiry, I also use simulations and animations in my teaching. Now, you do not have to have lots of tablets or computers in your classroom to use this. Okay, so even if you just wanted to have it on your computer, that's great. Anybody use FET simulations that I have listed here? Yes, they are awesome. Okay, let me show you some of these. I also gave you a lesson that I got off of this website. So if you go to FET simulations, they're actually produced by the University of Colorado out of Boulder. And let me show you what some of them look like. they come with lesson plans that people post. So it's not like this, the University of Colorado makes them. Teachers across the country or world make lesson plans, and they can post them through this website where these animations are. Again, I've given you all these resources. And you can play with this. I mean, the students literally, instead of me at the board saying, okay, we're going to talk about the law of reflection or we're going to talk about refraction, the students can use the simulation and learn as they're playing with the simulation what refraction means. Right? Refraction is just the bending of light when light moves from one medium to another. They can figure that out. Because, again, they can use the little protractor. And the protractor, they can measure the angle. They can actually look at the intensity of the light as it's passing from here down into here. You can also change the index of refraction. You can use other types of materials. I mean, these types of simulations are just phenomenal. And I gave you, again, one of the lesson plans, which gives a lot of activities that the students can be doing to, again, be practicing what does this look like, and from this, learn about the bending of light. Another one I use is the SAS curriculum pathways. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But SAS curriculum pathways, as you can see, is free K-12 learning and beyond. And they have these awesome resources. I've used this one in the past about the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, and I just wanted to pull up some of these resources that you could see. It gives you such great things that you can put, give to your students, and again, make this be a guided inquiry process. So instead of just sitting out, in front of the classroom saying, well, in 1918, there was Spanish flu and it was a pandemic. Anybody know what a pandemic means? I mean, you can get them to see it was all over the world. And these maps, which are, great epidemiological studies, actually show how did the Spanish flu move across the world? Where did it come from? They can actually be the epidemiologist again and figure out, who was the original patient to capture this illness. So anyway, I want to give you a little glimpse. I don't have time to go into all the details of just some of these websites, some of these resources that are out there for you so that you can teach from this inquiry perspective. Get your kids, your students to be the discoverer and not just you telling them or disseminating the information. Something else that I do a lot in class is have students create models and representations. Now, I am not a huge, I can use technology, but I'm not like a tech-savvy person, so the little video I'm getting ready to show you, it was actually done by ninth graders and made by ninth graders. Have you ever made a stop-motion video, like where you just take a bunch of pictures and link them together? Okay, that's what they did. So this is all mitosis, and it's great, but it's not great, so I'm going to have you watch it, and this is going to show you mitosis. It's just pipe cleaners, by the way. Now, all they did was play with pipe cleaners. They then took lots of pictures of the different stages, and then we linked them together. But they loved it. And guess what? They did fabulous when it came to assessment time on mitosis. And I did basically hardly any, no lecture. Yeah. It was so much fun. And don't get me wrong, I love to talk. I love to lecture. And I think I do a pretty good job. But at the same time, this is much more effective. They're active in class. We actually look at onion root tips. You guys do that too? I actually have them look at onion root tip slides, and they put together the steps of mitosis. And I say, yes, that's correct. Once they have done it on their own without any work, right, because you don't need to, the steps of mitosis were made by humans looking at plants. I have them look at the onion root tip slides. They put them into order. I say, yes, you're correct. So let's give names to these phases. And then we make these videos and all kinds of other fun stuff. So I encourage you to use these simulations, use animations, use models and representations so that they are creating these things themselves. So let's stop for a second again. And let's go back and look at our list. What scientific practices have we taught just by having the kids use models, representations, using simulations, animations, all that good stuff? You can call them out. What have we used? Awesome. Anything else? Awesome. Anything else you can think of? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And we did. When we actually reviewed for our test, one of the things we did was like, do you guys want to watch your videos again? Yeah! Okay, let's watch them. And then we talked through, okay, what part was that? Oh, yeah, that's, you know, prometaphase, or that's metaphase, and there's the microtubules come in for, you know, to separate them. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else? Absolutely. And you know how I made it even better? Because we're going to get to argumentation in a second. I actually had them vote on which one was the better. Because if you notice, it says 9B, because I have three sections of ninth grade. So we had A, B, C section. And we voted on who was best and why. And so they had to actually, they voted. And then we had representatives who kind of said, well, this is why we voted this way. It was really awesome. It was great. All right, let's keep moving. Another way that you can teach scientific practices is, again, have your students design experimental procedures. I will tell you, this was scary to me at first, right? I'm a cookie-cutter kind of girl, right? Like, you just give me the recipe, I'm going to follow it, we're going to have an awesome time because I know the results are going to work. Because don't you hate it when you do an experiment and the results aren't right? Ugh. So this was hard for me to let go, but it has really been a blessing to see how the students have really learned so much more by making those mistakes, by not getting good data, than getting all the perfect data. For instance, instead of just saying, hey, we're going to calculate the K, which is spring constants of springs. Again, it's okay if you don't know what that means. But instead of just telling them these are the steps we're going to follow, I put them into groups and I said, okay, we've been studying mass spring systems and spring constants. I want you and your group to come up with two ways to calculate the K of a mass spring system and actually do it. So I gave them a spring. They had to come up with two ways to do it experimentally and actually get the answer. They loved it. That was fun, right? Because they had to use their minds and be actively engaged in class and come up with the procedures for that. Something else that we have done, again, we've done this very slowly because this is a little bit of a financial investment, is use probeware. Anybody here familiar with Vernier probeware or Logger Pro software? Okay. As you are able, again, I gave you the resource. I don't have time to show you all the details. I would ask that you go to that website and take a look. So probeware is literally that. They're probes, like motion detectors, force sensors, all kinds of different things. They have great dynamics tracks for my physics teachers and here are physical science teachers. And what you do is you connect that probe to your computer, and the data is collected by the detector, goes into what's called Logger Pro software, and then the students actually can have really specific, very precise data from their experiments, and they love it. And for those who are headed off to a four-year university or even a community college or other places of study, if they're going to head into the sciences, they're going to need to be somewhat familiar, if we can, with that probeware, because I know my students who are coming back from university are saying, oh, Ms. McDonald, it was so great that we had experience with that, because in my physics lab in college, we were already expected to know how to use that probeware. Oh, good, awesome. And it gives them, again, an opportunity to look at graphs of data, interpret analysis of data, all this great stuff. So, again, I wish we had more time to go into that, but I did want to mention it, that you can be using that probeware in your classrooms. The other thing, too, actually, we're going to keep moving. Sorry, I want to make sure that we finish good here on time. All right, so something else I'd like to talk about as well is I want to require my students to present and defend their positions and explanations. And these are some students actually in our rising 12th grade class this year now, but this is from 11th grade, and this was, it might be hard to tell, but it's actually their analysis using a spectrophotometer. They analyzed food dyes. It was really cool. Okay, so they actually got absorption spectrums from the different food dyes using the spectrophotometer. And what they did is they basically wrote a laboratory report from scratch, which John Mays has great information about too, if you aren't having your students do that yet. And then we put it on a poster. And the beauty of putting that lab report on a poster with all its different parts is that then the students actually had to present their work. It was like we had our own mini conference. It was so cool. Right? You guys have been to a real scientific conference. That sounds terrible. But you know I'm trying to say, like a professional scientific conference, and everybody has their poster presentation. In essence, we were teaching them how to do poster presentations for if they're going to do that in the future. But it was a great way for them to present their information. They had to defend their work. The peers in the class reviewed the work as well, and in addition to just the teacher. And then, of course, they had to explain what they were doing from that. So have you guys ever done these poster presentations? This is something, yeah, good, awesome. I'm glad people are doing that. That's wonderful. Another thing, too, is make sure you're incorporating mathematics very early into this. You can see that they have graphs. It might be hard to see, but they have their graphs there from the absorption spectrum, their data, et cetera. So I always want to encourage you guys to make sure that you're incorporating mathematics as well. something else to teach scientific practices. Use ambiguity in the classroom. We're a lot of times afraid of this because we don't want to offend people, that type of thing. By ambiguity, I mean things that don't have clear-cut right answers. So some easy ones that I put up here are GMOs, and then, of course, dual nature of light. We kind of have come to an agreement that it's both, but yes, that's ambiguous, right? How can something be both? Sometimes you could do vaccine debates. Some people get really into that, all those types of things. PBS has great resources. This is actually just a screenshot here to the right of the Harvest of Fear. Again, you know, vet these sources, and you can make sure that they're presenting both sides of the argument, and usually PBS does a good job of doing that. But this is one that I'm actually going to use this year. I haven't used yet. Have any of you guys actually used ambiguity like this in the classroom? That's great. What are some of the other topics that you've done? I was thinking climate change would be a good one. Yeah, that's good. Anybody else? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, that's good. Cloning's a good, yeah. I was hoping somebody would mention that one too. Good. Something else is, I actually think this ambiguity can start a little bit younger than just high school. I think start in middle school. I would probably do the dual nature of light if I was a middle school teacher, and I would have my students be presented with the data for why light's a wave, present them with the data for why light is a particle, and actually let them fight it out. It's so much fun. I mean, that's argumentation. That's the practice of what happened 100 years ago. People fought it out. Well, we should teach them how to do that because we still have ambiguous scientific content today, just like the ones that you guys have described. Good. I also want to encourage you to use a variety of assessments. This is also something new for me. One of the ways that I used to teach was, well, basically how I was taught. You know, you do kind of the standard quizzes and tests on paper with your pencil and your calculator. And the last couple years, I've really rethought that. And I thought, you know what? Science is not always a calculator and a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper and a bunch of problems. Science is real life. So, for instance, these are pictures, the right-hand side, are pictures of my seniors making musical instruments as the test for their unit on waves and simple harmonic motion, and we did harmonics and frequencies and stuff like that. It was the coolest thing ever. They loved it. And here was what the test was. They had 2 days of class time to, with their group, design a musical instrument that could play a full octave scale, could play a simple song, was made of only household materials. They couldn't go out and buy anything fancy. It had to be like trash. As you can see, it's like trash. It's like pipes and cups and stuff like that. So they had to use household materials. They couldn't buy anything. They had to actually make their instrument, had to play a full octave scale, play a simple song, and they had to calculate all the frequencies, like the number, and tell me what it was. So let me actually go ahead. I'm going to show you that what they, well, two of the groups came up with. So here's a water bottle xylophone and then an actual PVC xylophone. Don't you love the One Direction duct tape? I just had to giggle. I was like, all right, it's in the picture, whatever. But you'll notice that you can actually really see it on the one xylophone. They actually have what it is. It's like A3. That's the actual note. And they figured that out using the mathematics that we had studied, but they actually made it. And they played music. I almost cried in class. I was like, this is beautiful. And then I had a student who, with the water xylophone, you can see he got all the, they marked all the notes, and he took all the caps, and they had appointed one guy to be the player, and he had practiced, right? So they built it the first day, he practiced the second day. Oh, and of course, then they had to present these to the class. Again, argumentation. Present your work. Defend what you did. How is this working? How did you figure this out? And he, it was fabulous. I mean, the kids were videoing. I gave permission to do that. And I was just like, this is awesome. And it was their test. And now I did have a rubric very specifically. Not everybody got 100, okay? Don't get me wrong. I'm not grade inflating. But in essence, they learned so much more by calculating those frequencies and building these instruments than if they had sat there with a calculator and a pencil and a paper for 55 minutes taking the test. It was great. Another test utilizes this picture in the front left that I couldn't bring in. But this is a picture of what are called pith balls. You guys ever seen them? They're like these little styrofoam things. Okay, so every group got a set of pith balls and a balloon. Well, of course, in a ring stand. They had to calculate the charge on these pith balls. Okay, so I'll help some people because I got people like, what? All right, so what you do is you like rub the balloon in your hair. You rub one of the pitfalls. Of course, they go away from each other. They actually could calculate how many coulombs of charge were on there. It was phenomenal. So again, instead of just a calculator and a pencil and a paper, the test was to, with your group, determine the amount of, the charge on each of your balls. You had to actually go through and write the procedures. They actually had to turn into me a lab report about it with a calculation. And I checked all their work, and it was just awesome. It was awesome. This, my friends, is how you teach scientific practices. And still, you're teaching scientific content. So let's review for just a second. What other scientific practices, or maybe at this point we've hit them all, have we reached? What kind of practices have we taught just using these ideas so far? Again, we can kind of call them out. So what have we? Have we gotten everything? Okay. One last thing I want to mention, and then we're going to kind of tidy this all up together, is also I would encourage you to have your students participate in what's called a citizen science project. Anybody ever done this? Oh, no. Oh, I'm excited. Good. And new information for you. All right, let me show you what this is. So citizen science projects are where you have your students go out into the world and participate in real-life science that is happening right now. And a great website, I gave, again, all these resources to you, is National Geographic. They actually have a whole list, which should come up here in just a moment, of all the different types of citizen science projects that are occurring in all the different areas. I'm just going to go through some of these. You can actually participate in monitoring water quality, looking at urban birds, monitoring bird nests. You can do these things with your students as an ongoing project. The migration of the monarch butterfly is another one. If you're in the path of the monarch butterfly, we are not in North Carolina, but I know of. You can participate in the horseshoe count, which can happen. Bird counts, butterfly census. Again, there's pages of all these projects that you can have your students participate with lots of other scientists and citizen scientists around the world. It's just phenomenal. So one of the ones I think I'm going to do is water quality monitoring, because we study water in my ninth grade class, and I was like, that would be great. And actually, when I was in college, I actually interned for, I was living in Maryland at the time, for the Department of Natural Resources, so I know lots about that anyway, and I thought, we're going to do this. We're going to do some water quality monitoring ourselves and actually report the data, and our data will be part of a bigger project. I mean, how cool is that? To see that your students, what they're doing in the science classroom is not just playing school, but they're actually contributing to the knowledge that we have about whatever it is in our world, be it water quality monitoring or census of butterflies, etc. So lastly, let's talk about why are we not all teaching this way? Maybe why were we not taught this way? What are your thoughts on this? What are some barriers maybe that you feel? If you don't, that's great. But are there any barriers that you thought? What are your thoughts on this idea of teaching scientific practices in order for us to hang that scientific content onto it? Right. And actually, I want to tell you a little conversation I had the other night. So I had, a lady came up and was like, oh, we're just chatting. She's like, what curriculum do you use at your school? And my friend here can vouch for this, because I actually stopped for a second. I was like, I don't know how to answer that question, because I don't know what to tell her other than, well, I can give you pages of resources that I've put together. Because you're right, a curriculum, a lot of times people are looking for, just give me a book and I'll teach the book and here's all. That's not this. Right? This requires kind of a gathering of resources and really a good thinking through. What is it that you want to teach? Teach these scientific practices. What content do you want to teach, and how do you marry that together in the classroom? Sure. Something else. Yeah, and I was talking about this with the group up here, and I said the beautiful thing is I find now, and I've been doing this for quite a few years, I'm not teaching less anymore. I'm actually teaching the same amount that I always taught. It's all integrated together. Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely. Sure. Right. And I would say that again is something that you as a teacher and I just think we all should be working together on this, is what do we need to offer as the base first, right? What do we need to offer as the base so that they are ready to work? I actually also think, too, we've talked about this at our school, is if you start this earlier, they understand that this is what science looks like. But if you wait till middle school, they are highly distracted. I mean, they are going through puberty. It's crazy. And then to all of a sudden say, hey, now we're going to put you in, more of a, not the driver's seat, that's not the right word, but we're going to try to get you to discover things. Well, like, hey, it's playtime. Well, no. Right? So you've got to start this from, I think, much earlier so they realize learning is active. Right? We don't want our kids coming through. Even my own children have shared this with me. They're like, no, Mom, school's just kind of like you sit there and they like tell you stuff. No! What are we doing? And I'm like, no, that's not what it is. And so if we can start this earlier, then by the time we get them in high school, because that's what I teach, then this is what they're used to. And we don't have as many issues with that. So like this past year, I had 12th graders that I had as 9th graders, and it was such a productive, fun year. Where in the past, I'd had to retrain some of the 12th graders a little bit when I got them again. But now that I'd gotten kids I had in 9th grade, I didn't find that as much of an issue. Other thoughts real quick. What are some other maybe barriers that you think about this in the far back? Yes, ma'am. Yes? Yeah, absolutely. So I was hoping somebody would say that because that was my next slide. So I think this is the biggest barrier. People think, well, this must take a lot of money or just a lot of resources. And that was the beauty of HOPE, of that whole list of things I've given you, is start there. Really quickly, the internet sites that I use a lot of are Biology Corner, Biology Junction. These are sites that a couple different teachers have, basically they run them, but they're putting ideas that they're getting from all kinds of people on there, and they're phenomenal. And then you have to kind of sift through and, again, go through those practices that I went through. Make sure that you're just problematizing. I mean, that doesn't really cost money, right? If I can just problematize what I'm doing, if I can make sure I'm teaching it from that guided inquiry perspective, and we can talk about that privately, but a lot of that doesn't cost money. Now, when it comes to maybe the hands-on part, if it's a laboratory experiment, you can do just about anything using just household materials. You really, really can. I pretty much teach physics using household materials. Or things that we've just built over years. And I would encourage you to do the same thing. Virtual labs, do not be ashamed of them. Right? If you don't have money for a gel electrophoresis, that's okay. I will show you this one. I think it's fun. It's got really loud noise. I apologize. But if you go to this one, you guys ever use this one? Oh no. Oh, that's not good. Okay, hold on. We'll do another one. Let's see if this one will come up. This might be just a listing. Yeah, so this is Biology Junction. This is a whole listing of websites that are all just virtual labs. And let's just see if we can click on the Rutgers one real quick. Here we go. I mean, this stuff's all just out there for free. And then, let's click here to enter. All right, there we go. I mean, you can start looking at some of these. Hold on. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at this one yet. But anyway, these are all available online. I love this one from the genetics out of University of Utah, because they actually go through the gel electrophoresis process, but it's all virtual. So if you can't actually afford one, this is still fabulous. And they'll still understand the whole process of how you're going to be inserting the digested DNA into the wells, et cetera. So that's a good one. Also, use the internet and peers and collaborate. This is something I know we've been working on at our school. It's just increasing our collaboration with each other and just keep looking for ideas and go to those websites where they're posted. I go to Biology Junction and Biology Corner for all of my biology stuff. I mean, very regularly. And then I get links to other things. And then over the years, I just keep all those resources. So I'm at the point now where my curriculum is literally these notebooks of every quarter of my class that I've created. And I don't teach a textbook. I don't, because my class is all these resources put together. Again, within the framework of I'm teaching these practices, and that content that I want to teach is going to be hung onto those practices as well. So I just want to leave us, and I also want to make sure we have a few minutes, because, yeah, we still have a few minutes for questions as well. There are some different books and things out there. I listed them in the resources page. Like John Mays has a great one. It's his favorite experiments in physics and physical science. If you haven't bought that, you should. I think it was just great. It's using household materials as well. And remember what our goal is. I mean, our goal is to train these students to be the next generation of disciples for Christ. And that's disciples in all these different fields of study. So I want my students to be the best scientific thinkers, because, man, they're going to be the next generation of engineers and doctors and physicists and nurses and whatever. In addition to also those people who aren't headed into those fields, I still want them to be great scientific thinkers. So if they are, let's say, a business person, a businessman, I still want them to be able to read the news about science and be able to understand whether that's false or correct. So I don't care what field of study you're headed, what your vocation, your calling is going to be before God, you need to know how to think scientifically so that you can be an educated citizen, an educated, you know, member of our society, and you can make good choices. And I can't tell you how many people walk around so scientifically uneducated. Well, that's not my thing. I don't care if it's not your thing. You still need to know what it means to think scientifically and to do that critically. So thank you so much for your attention. I guess while we do this, we still literally do have about 5 minutes for questions, and then we can formally close. So anything that you guys would like to ask for the good of the group? Yes, ma'am. I do too. I understand. I will be completely honest with you. I don't have a planning period either, so I teach 6 classes and no break. I'll tell you this, it's just come with time. And so if you feel overwhelmed, I would just start with a couple of units, right? So say, you know what, I'm just going to start implementing some of these ideas. And really, if you can just, even just the problematizing your lessons, sorry, I think I pulled on that too hard, that will be great. I'm sorry, guys. I don't know what happened. So if you can just start problematizing your lessons, that'll be phenomenal, because then you can start with that. And go from there. And so some of the other resources that I've given you, I think, are helpful. Like the COBOL books are really good. I would encourage you to go. They are really inexpensive from $25. I can't remember. I think it's less than $10. But other questions? Sure. So I start the year off with just the idea of what is science, why are we doing this, especially as Christians. I actually talked about, I think, a little bit of a worldview, like you mentioned, but that really is only a Christian worldview that should study science. We should have to have a rational universe. And so, for those who are atheists and scientists, are sort of borrowing from Christianity in order to work. So, start off with that. Then we go into really, I think, like the biological molecule first. We do a little bit of just basic physical science review, and then biological molecule broader. Then we go from there into cells and cell processes. And then in my last day class, we have a whole human physiology course. Then I go right into the human body system, trying to integrate everything that we learned from cell processes. No, so that was just in general. So really, I don't know how many units I've got in it, but I do about 2 weeks per unit is usually the track that I run. So I can't remember, I go right from the introduction to science and scientific inquiry, and then we go into the review of the atomic model and patterns, and then we go from there into biological molecules, and then we go from there into water and more. I go right into and of course, none of these are going to include other processes. You know, chemistry in there, and that sort of thing. Then we go into cells, then we do a whole 2 week on cell membranes, which are so important. Go from there into cell respiration after that, and then television, like cultures, and then and actually, if you just want to email me, I'm happy to email that out. And my scoping sequence has this many details. That's just how I have to have it. And so it lists a lot of the activities right in there. Mm-hmm. Okay. She got real happy. She was like, not at all. I just hadn't thought about it yesterday. I need to think about whether it would be the movie to actually tell them what I'm trying to get them to do. I think there might be, in that ninth grade level, that's in my 12th grade, I think they know it because I am explicit in, you are designing this, you are doing this. And in ninth grade, they do the designing as well, but it's, you know, they're still 14, 14 and a half, 15 years older. So, I don't know if you want to go home. So I still need a lot of written questions as well. My goal is to half and half for this year. I wasn't this past year because, again, I kind of just like for you guys, it wasn't like I woke up one morning and was like, hey, what am I going to do? This has taken years of just changing my own thinking because I was not trained this way. This is so against how all of my education was. And so it's taken me to unlearn how I was taught to teach better. And I would say this past year was probably about 30 written. This year I want to take it to 60. And when I do a written assessment, even in physics, I want them writing. So there's no, I shouldn't say there's no multiple choice. If I do a multiple choice, I'm still going to require that they write out stuff, but I did push a credit on multiple choice. No, it's not. But I love them to be that way, even if I answer them. If they can show me in work, or if it's I need to write out something, then I will write that because I want to just know what they know. That's why I come to myself, tell me what you really want to know. I want to know what you know. I want to know what you know. I want to know what you know. And actually, when I first started teaching, and this is a long time ago now, I actually was in Maryland, and we but the Exploring Creation series, my Dr. J. Lyle originally was what I was using, and he is great resources for to kind of help them, because they all have a school book. And there, though, if you're going to use a homeschool book, there's the one that most familiar with it. Because I think a lot of what I'm doing already, just learned to tell quite quickly. But I don't necessarily, I don't know if I'm going to choose to do it, but maybe it's already working for me. I have a real thing now. I don't want to take any more of your time. If you have other questions, I'm happy to answer. Thank you again for your time. Again, my information is on there.